The Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
Hello, everyone. Welcome once again to the Round Golf Podcast. Now, it's pretty rare when I do one of these interviews that I meet my interviewee for the very first time. It's almost like a blind date, isn't it? Really, you don't know if you're going to hit it off, what the chemistry will be like. And actually, I had a blind date once and I'm now married to the lady, but you'll be pleased to know me and Davis obviously are very much a part in that manner. But I couldn't have been more charmed by him, really couldn't. This is a guy who's won so many times on the PGA Tour, major winner. I think only something like 20 odd men have won more times on the PGA Tour than the Davis Love III. But it's not about the individual so much with him, as you're going to hear. It's the Ryder Cup that it's the centre of our conversation. So, Davis, you've chosen Costantino Rocca in the match in the singles 1993 Ryder Cup. Why that round above anything else?
There's no greater pressure than Ryder Cup. There's no greater pressure than trying to get the last point of the Ryder Cup on an away game. You know, the U.S. team's at the Belfry, and I'm a rookie, and I've got Captain Tom Watson and player Raymond Floyd and player Lanny Watkins and player Tom Kite, all my heroes, and I'm the rookie guy. And it looks like, with five or six holes to go, I'm going to have to come back and win this match. So the long story short would be the most pressure I'd been under. Wanted so badly for, you know, to win the Ryder Cup, to win with my partner Tom Kite. All those things had built up that week. And
let me rewind then, because I mean, you go out the first morning and you've mentioned it there, you were with Tom Kite, you've mentioned one of your heroes, your youngest member of the team, and you take on Señor Ballesteros and Señor Olazabal.
I mean, what a pair. We caught the Spanish Armada right out of the gate. My first Ryder Cup match, we had been begging Watson to pair us together. I kept telling Kite, go talk to Tom, you know, tell him we want to play together. And it was natural for me, spending so much time with Kite during my career because of my dad, had a great relationship with him. We played so many rounds together, practiced so much together, that I was going to be the most comfortable playing with him. Luckily, I was with him, and then we draw Seve and Jose. Well, unfortunately, we did win the first match. Unfortunately, we drew him again and again.
You got them angry, didn't you?
Yeah. I say we beat them once, we gave them one, and they beat us once out of the three. But it was funny because Watson, we played together in the morning, we won, so he sent us back out. We got him again, and we lost, but he said, well, you guys need to go again because you're playing so well. You'll never have to play them again. Well, next morning we have to play them again. And when he saw the draw, he goes, you're definitely sitting out after three times against them. So I'd had a rough week already going into the singles, but it was a thrill to get to play. And Seve and I were friends as well, because of my relationship with my dad. Obviously, didn't know Jose Maria that well.
Sorry, when you say your dad, how was he, the relationship with him and Seve?
My dad, in his, you know, playing career and his teaching career, and his kind of well-known status as a club pro, a lot of these pros knew my dad, especially, you know, the Seve generation, the Tom Kite generation. They knew my dad, one as a player and as a great teacher. But Seve was always looking for information, looking for people who wanted to talk golf. And so my dad hit it off with him a little bit. And then naturally, I had an entree that Seve would be nice to me. I was not just another kid on the tour. He knew who I was. And Seve was always great to me. We practiced some together. I followed him around like a puppy dog when I could. So to get to play against him after all that was just incredible. Obviously, he was the European Ryder Cup team in 93. He was the intimidation factor. He was the leader of the team. So he was pulling along the young kid, Jose Maria, obviously. But it was quite a challenge, but it was a thrill to get to play against him. But not what you'd wish on anybody, to play him three times in one Ryder Cup.
So let's get to the round then. You're in the singles, Costantino Rocca,
And I don't know where you want me to go to, but I know you were one down with two to play. Yeah. So
I had not played great, and he had played, and as he always did, he seemed to play a little bit better than you expected him to play, no matter where it was. He always got a lot out of his game. He did not look like Fred Couples out there making it look easy. He looked like he was working very hard to get the ball in the hole. But he had chipped in, he had made a long putt, I had not done anything spectacular, and I had consistently stayed like one down. So it was getting to the point where we got to 16 and people started showing up. And it's like in Caddyshack when everybody comes out of the woods to watch the last putt. And the Ryder Cup, when all the wives and the players that are done come to watch you, you know you're in trouble.
So even as a rookie, you knew?
Oh yeah, you know. I had played Walker Cup and I'd been around enough to know I was in trouble, you know, that I had to flip my match. And to make it worse, Watson shows up on 16 and walks over to 17T with me. And he literally says to me, "We really need this point." And I was like, I'm smart enough that I've figured that out already. And he's nervous. And one thing I learned from that, obviously 11 years later as a captain, you got to think before you say something to your players, because you might not be helping them by just going out and talking to them.
Sure.
So, but what he did was he made me think positive, because that was not really a positive statement. That was not a Bob Rotella sports psychology moment. But what he did was he made me try to calm him down. So I said, "Hey, Tom, he has chipped in. He has made every putt. He's due to miss one, and I'm due to make one." So I turned it into a positive for me. Sure enough, he three-putted the next hole. I got on 18, hit my best drive of the day. I felt like I had hope, because now I was even. And I hit a great drive and maybe the wrong club on the second shot and spun it off the shelf. And I made the putt because I turned it into a positive for me. I'm due to win this thing. You know, he's due for a bad break. And, you know, I always laugh when I start out onto the fairway as assistant captain or as a captain to go say something to a player. I could really mess this up rather than help. I told Steve Stricker in 2012, I said, "Don't worry, everything's going fine. Don't look at the leaderboards. The guys behind you are doing fine. And then he looked like he calmed down. And we got after the fact. I said, "That didn't help you at all, did it?" He goes, "No, I knew you were BSing me." So the captain really needs to stay out of the way, let him go play. But Tom being there made me feel important, because the captain came to talk to me. And I think what he said wasn't great, but what it did is it kicked me into gear for the last two holes. So I think I learned something there, that no matter what the situation, I have to rely on my positive attitude and my routine, which on the last hole, I knew I was not going to make the putt, and I backed off. And my hands were shaking. I knew I was going to miss, and I backed off, and I said, the only way to make this putt is to do my routine. And at home, my brother, who had stopped caddying for me, everybody gasped when I backed off the putt. And he said, "Oh, no, no. When he backs off, that means he's not ready. Now he's going to do his routine. He's going to make it." And sure enough, I got over it. I did my look, set, let it go. I looked up, and the ball was going in the hole. And I put my hands up because I had done my routine and it worked. I was not really celebrating that we had won the Ryder Cup. Like, "Oh, that worked." Because I just stood over it and said, "This is not going to work." And to have Lanny Watkins come out and all the guys that, you know, had played so many Ryder Cups, and I was the kid that got the point. At the time, I didn't realize the significance of it. Watching Ryan Moore putt the last putt at Hazeltine, I knew the significance of what it meant for a rookie first-time Ryder Cupper to get the clinching point. Even though we knew it was over when he played the hole, it was still, he would always be remembered as getting the final point at Hazeltine. So it was an incredible moment. And I think that gave me confidence going forward, whether it was a major championship, a Ryder Cup, Presidents Cup, that I could rely on my routine and my confidence to get me through it.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is about you, but seeing as you've chosen that Ryder Cup, it happened to be unbelievably still the last time the USA have won on European soil. If I'd have told you that then, back then, you probably wouldn't have believed me, would you?
No. I wouldn't have believed you, you know, in 2016 if you'd have said we weren't going to win in Paris. I feel like our team is better than we play on the road. I think it shows what fans mean. It shows what a home course advantage means. But, you know, we have just not played well. At 93, I thought we had the best team. In 95, we lost. I thought we had the best team. 97, Valderrama, we had a great team and we just got crushed. I mean, we made it look good at the end, but we really got crushed the first 2 days. So, yeah, I would have never believed that we would not have won at least half of them on the road, much less zero of them on the road since 93.
That's incredible, isn't it? Just that Ryder Cup itself, that whole experience for you, it's 20 plus years ago. How much of it do you remember? You were vividly there describing.
I remember probably more about that one than any other, but I remember the weeks of Ryder Cups, whether it was assistant captain for Corey Pavin in 2010 when it just rained the whole week. I remember more little things about that. I didn't even play, but we come together so much as a team for that week. Tom Watson sat us down in the Concord Lounge in, I think, New York City to fly to the 93 Ryder Cup. And he said, guys, this is going to be one of the biggest adventures of your life. He made it seem so big. And I was blown away by that statement. And then to think that it was even bigger than he said. You know, to us, the Belfry was a foreign territory, you know, that we'd seen on TV. You know, remember, it's 1993. You know, not as much TV,
sure,
not as much exposure. So the Belfry was, you know, foreign ground for a lot of us, especially me, younger guys, to go over there and play there, kind of the home of European golf, to play with Kite the first match. And I tried to convince him. We talked all week about I was hitting on the odd holes and he was going to hit on the even holes. And I'm walking to the first tee going, I think you should hit on the odd holes. And he said, why? I said, because I just figured out one's an odd hole and I have to hit first. And to lead Tom Kite off the tee in a Ryder Cup was just more pressure than I thought. So little things like playing board games at night and Tom Watson telling us to go to bed. There were so many, Paul Azinger, Payne Stewart, so many great things happened to me during the Ryder Cups that that'll just stick vividly. Now, I will forget, you'll remind me of some golf shots of that round, but the camaraderie, the dinners, the things that happened with the wives, the travel together, just memories you can't ever replace. And that's what makes us, both the European team and the U.S. team, so passionate about the Ryder Cup, because it's not just about the golf, it's getting to come together as a team.
Yeah, this interview is about your life and your story, and we're starting here this round, and it's interesting. You could have chosen maybe a first win on the PGA Tour. Of course, you could have chosen the major. You could have chosen winning at the age of 51 as well. But it's interesting that you've chosen that team environment above that.
Well, rounds that shaped my career, which I was 7 years into my career, but rounds that shaped my career or that shaped what I felt about the Ryder Cup, or what I wanted to do in the Ryder Cup. I think that round, those three matches against Seve Ballesteros and Jose Maria, obviously Jose Maria and down the road were captained against each other. So many things that in that 93, in that round, made me want to be a Ryder Cup player, maybe want to be on the Ryder Cup team. I just finished a conversation with Steve Stricker and Tiger Woods that I will do whatever I can to help any team that they're involved in. I don't have to be assistant captain. I just want to be a part of the team. You know, I've enjoyed it so much. Played six of each, you know, captain, assistant captain on President's Cups and Ryder Cups. I think starting in 1993, that round, winning a singles match, getting a point that clinched. I think it just cemented what the Ryder Cup and what team competition meant for me.
When you're growing up, as a kid, and your dad, as you mentioned here, playing in events, playing in majors, obviously a renowned coach as well, and you've got a son now maybe going through the same experience, did you feel the pressure of coming onto a tour and turning pro, or was it just the most natural thing in the world to you?
It was a natural goal. My dad was a pro, so when I was a little kid, your dad's a fireman, you want to be a fireman. I wanted to be a famous golfer like my dad. Didn't know what that meant. But at 12 or 13 or 14, I knew my dad was a great teacher, and I wanted to be a pro golfer. I needed to listen to him. So it was a natural thing. Coming out on the tour, I was a little more comfortable maybe than any other rookie, because I knew Ben Crenshaw. If I got paired with Tom Kite, or I ran into Arnold Palmer, he knew who I was. I didn't have to introduce myself. I find myself, when I see a kid wide-eyed in the locker room staring at me, I go and introduce myself, because I know he's nervous to talk to me. I'm the one that should be making him feel at ease, like Arnold Palmer or Jack Nicklaus or Leonard Thompson. Just the regular guys that knew my dad would make me feel comfortable in the locker room or on the practice tee, give me a spot to hit. Just in Honolulu, I made room for a kid to hit balls, because I knew that's what Tom Kite would have done for me. Gave me room to do my practice. So I felt a little more comfortable. My dad made the tour a dream for me, but he also made it a reality for me, because I saw it. I got to go to major championships with him, got to be around it. My dad ran a PGA Tour event at his home course, Atlanta Country Club, so the pros came every year. I always tell the story that I sold lemonade at the first Players Championship at Atlanta Country Club, because my dad was the host pro on the second hole, and then I ended up playing in the Players Championship when I grew up. So my dad gave me a great leg up, for sure.
He did, and obviously, we know the awful nature of the way your dad passed away. Don't want to go into that per se. I just want to ask you, though, that grief to me is a very personal thing. How hard has it been for you to be, asked, and, people want to know this, when really kind of none of their business and it's your own personal thing?
Well, it's part of my career, though. My dad was, say, one of the top 10 teachers in the world. And he had put this kid on to the tour in 1986. Tragically, in the fall of 88, he was gone. It was a shock to the golf world. We're a small community, but obviously it was a shock to our golf world. I had, won on the PGA Tour and was making a name for myself. And it was definitely a tragedy. My best friend was in the plane crash with my dad. He was a young, up-and-coming teacher. Our head professional was in there. So it was a tragedy all around for family and friends at home. But it was a shock to my career. Now, luckily, I had people like Peter Costas that taught with my dad, and Jack Lumpkin that taught with my dad, and Butch Harmon to take over as teachers. But I still had to deal with the family part of it. That was very tough. But my dad set me up to play the tour, set me up. I wrote a book, Every Shot I Take, about my dad, because I think about him every time I play golf, because I can't get by without the left arm only drill or the little things that he taught me. Now I'm passing those on to my son, who never got to take a lesson from my dad. So I was very blessed. He was taken early, but great lessons in the years that I did have him.
And obviously for your mom as well, who I understand can shoot her age.
She did. Unfortunately, she had a stroke about 3 years ago, but for 50 plus years, she was a single digit handicap, shot her age, and putted with the same putter. So patience and perseverance, I think, comes from my mom.
Apologies butting in. We'll be back with Davis Love in just a moment, but I've got to tell you about a superb golf game, the Fitzdares Fantasy Players Championship. It's only open to UK residents, so apologies to those of you listening in various parts of the globe. You have to be 18 years of age as well to play, but it's really simple. All you got to do is pick a five-man team plus a reserve for the upcoming Players' Championship at Sawgrass. The winnings of your five players then are added up all together, and that's your final score. Now, it's just a tenner to enter. There's a £4,000 guaranteed prize pool as well. The winner takes 40% of the prize pot. You've got to be in the top 25 to win. The website will show you all the prize breakdowns that you need. You can enter more than one team. In fact, enter four, you get a fifth free. And you can also share the competition with a friend. So if they win, you'll get a percentage of that winnings too. You can follow your team's progress on a real-time leaderboard. I'm going to be entering a team, and here are my five. Ready for it? Francesco Molinari, Ricky Fowler, Sergio Garcia, Justin Thomas, and Bryson DeChambeau. My reserve will be Tommy Fleetwood. Follow those if you dare. So to get playing, for you to do so, go to fantasy.fitzdares.com. That's fantasy.fitzdares.com, where you'll also find the terms and conditions. As with all forms of gambling, make sure you play responsibly. Now back to my conversation with Davis Love.
You're listening to the Round Golf Podcast with Richard Kaufman.
I mean, 21 PGA Tour wins. I think only Sam Snead has won across four decades on the PGA Tour other than yourself. A major and everything like that. When you hear people say you've lacked the killer instinct and things like that, I mean, what's your reaction to that?
I would agree.
Really?
I would agree. I when I look back on my career, I say, yeah, I might have just barely made it into the Hall of Fame, or I just barely got to 20 wins, gets you a lifetime exemption. I got 21 so far.
Exactly. There could be more.
Yes, I could have played better. I could have had a more positive attitude, or a tougher demeanor. I watch these guys, and I see what makes Matt Kuchar play so well. I see what makes Tiger Woods play so well, or why Steve Stricker can keep coming back and continuing to play well in his 50s. And I wish I could go back and start over, but I wouldn't trade my life for a better career. I've had a great life. My family, happy, healthy. I've got kids, I've got grandkids. I've helicopter snowboarded. I've fished all over the world. I've done some incredible things. Took my kids on incredible trips and raised a family in the place I wanted to raise them in. When I was a kid on the tour, they questioned why I lived in a small town in South Georgia on the beach. Now there's maybe 20 tour pros living there. So I figured some things out in my career that made for a happy life. But I could have won a lot more golf tournaments. But my dad would tell you that I could have worked harder on my fitness. I could have worked harder on hitting balls. But he'd be proud of the things that I had accomplished in my career that weren't golf scores, Ryder Cup captain, Hall of Fame, Payne Stewart Award winner, things like that.
Yeah, but I'm surprised that you agree with that statement, because, you know, 450 weeks in the top 10 of the world, getting as high as world number two, winning all those events, I mean, that takes a winning mentality, doesn't it?
It does. But there's always somebody that better. They're arguing whether it's Tiger or Jack, right? So Tiger would like for there to be no argument that he is the best player ever. We always want to be a little bit better. I always look at it as Tiger's 180, Phil's won about 40, and Davis is 120.
So what would you say then, given your talents then, if you could choose a number, what would you say would be a fair reflection?
Well, I always say if you gave me all my seconds, I'd still be way behind Tiger, because I think I've got 30 second place finishes on the tour. So if I got all my second places over the hump, I'd only have 50. But, you know, I should have won another couple majors probably. Jose Maria and Ben Crenshaw had some good finishes at the Masters that knocked me off. I blew a few of them. I definitely should have won a few more majors and could have won a few more tournaments. If I'd have known what I know now, I'd worked harder on my fitness. I might have had fewer injuries, slowed myself down. But I'm not disappointed in my career. I don't look back with
regret.
With regret, I look back and say, you know, I might not have gone to hundreds of horse shows and watched my daughter. I might not have seen my son play so many high school tournaments or college tournaments if I'd have been a better player or won more tournaments. So I don't know what the trade-off is, but I won't disagree at 54 years old. I won't disagree with people that say, hey, he could have done better.
Okay. But what about that win at the age of 51? What does that mean to you, winning it at that age, winning the Wyndham?
That was big for me because I'd had some big surgeries, some injuries that slowed me down. I always say to Tiger that I've got one record that he'll never break. I was the first one to win with a spinal fusion. So I had my neck fused. I had a couple other injuries, and to come back from that and get back competitive and win on the PGA Tour. Now my goal is I've got a new hip. It's almost a year old, so I'd like to get a win with this new hip. But it meant a lot. I kept saying, I don't need to go to the Champions Tour. If I putt well enough to win on the Champions Tour, I can win on the regular tour. Sure enough, that week at the Wyndham, I think I was first or second in strokes gained putting, and I won. I still feel that way. If I'm first or second in strokes gained putting, where Jordan Spieth seems to always be, if you make a lot of putts, the good ball striker should win. So generally, I can get more balls on the green than most players. I just got to make more putts than most players, and that's always my whole career. When I putted well, I played well. So I still feel that way. Winning on the Champions Tour is not a dream goal for me. Playing on the Champions Tour and enjoying the rest of my career will be. But winning one more, I'd rather play five more years on the PGA Tour and grind it out than win 10 times a year on the Champions Tour. I'd like the chance, like I had in Hawaii or like I had a couple times over the last few years, to get my name on the leaderboard and see if I can pull it off.
Sure. It's been an incredible career. In terms of when you came onto the circuit as a young whippersnapper, you were the biggest guy out there in terms of hitting it. Am I right? You carried a 3-wood 290, I heard. Is that right?
Yeah, I like with, Cameron
with,
Champ
with
now.
With wooden.
Wood, yeah. Like Cameron Champ now, I came out with a driver and no 3-wood for a while because I hit my 1-iron so far. I didn't need a 3-wood. I was the longest on the tour. Then along came John Daly and then the next generation of long hitters.
But people might not realize you were kind of the original John Daly, weren't you, really?
Yeah. I was not as much fun.
You were different. I mean, in terms of ball striking.
Yeah, I was, yeah. You know, and obviously it was before the massive amount of exposure that players get. John came out at just the right time, like Tiger did, and another just the right time to capture a bigger audience. But yeah, I was long, you know, I was the one that everybody talked about. Here he comes, he's going to be the longest, and he is the longest. And I won the driving distance category several years in a row, again, until John came along. Freddie was long. There were some long players, but I was consistently, and that's in college, amateur golf, that's where I made my money. I was long enough that I could get by without being a great putter or having a great, like Jack Nicklaus. Finally, that towards the end of his career, he said, I got to learn how to chip a little bit. I'm not hitting every green anymore. I had to do that when I hit the tour. I realized these guys can chip and putt. You know, I can hit it a long way, but I have to learn the short game. That's when I started working harder with Bob Rotella on my pre-shot routine, my mental attitude. I realized that on tour, I wasn't going to get away. I wasn't going to make it to the Hall of Fame, win a bunch of tournaments, just being a long hitter. And I think when you see that now, Cameron Champ is a smart player with a great putter, a pretty good wedge game, and he bombs it. You know, that's what you have to do. When you watch Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson, who's one of the best, most improved wedge players on the PGA Tour the last few years? Dustin Johnson. He's one of the longest hitters. That's a pretty good combination.
Nice, yeah.
And so I had to learn that when I came out. The power game is an advantage if you're willing to do the work on everything else. And I think we see that in Brooks and Dustin and Cameron, that they're willing to do the little things to get the rest of their game good.
But do you look at these guys and you go, I've been in those shoes?
Yeah. They talk about how I used to hit it. And Jack Nicklaus, he complains about how far the golf ball goes and how far guys hit it. He was that guy. You know, he was the long hitter in his day that bombed it by everybody, that was the only one that was driving the green or only one that was getting to the par 5 and 2. I was that guy for a little while, and I love the stories, but I won a lot of long drive contests. But you know, that's kind of passed me by now, and I'm enjoying. I played with Cameron Champ a couple rounds at the RSM Classic in the fall, and I said, you remind me so much of myself. You know, everybody wants to see you hit it. Everybody wants you to hit the driver, not the 2-iron off the tee. And it's fun to watch him. He's a very talented kid, and I think he gets it. And he'll do better with me than I did with the power thing. He'll be able to rein it in and play a good game all the time.
Just before we go, I just want to ask you, in terms of how you feel the game of golf is right now and what state it's in professionally and as a sport as a whole?
That's a great question, because professionally, I think the game's never been better. You know, we've got Tiger back, won a tournament last year. So many great stars. We've got Rory and Ricky and Jordan. These kids are just really good kids. Justin Thomas, just right on down the list. Our stars are great young men. That's great for TV, for majors, for professional golf, but we have to translate that down to growing the game. I think we're losing to year-round kids that play soccer, football. They don't just play soccer in soccer season. They just don't play basketball in basketball season. They play that sport year-round as little kids, and we're not gaining any golfers. So I think translating the excitement of a Jordan Spieth or a Cameron Champ to get more kids to play golf, to grow the game, I think is our biggest challenge. But on the pro side, we're great. USGA, the RNA, changing the rules, trying to make them simpler, trying to speed up the game. All those things are helping. And hopefully, in my elder years, I can help grow the game a little bit and pass it to a couple more generations.
And you've mentioned there about how you would like to be on the PGA Tour still for a number of years. And will you just keep playing and playing? You've mentioned a lot of players like Palmer and Nicklaus and Watson throughout this interview. Would you be like to be like them and, you know, still be doing it in your 60s? And
oh, I'd love to. I'm going to play on the Champions Tour as long as I can compete. But the regular tour, I'm about 40 tournaments away from playing more events than anybody's ever played on the PGA Tour. I've made a lot more cuts and played in a lot more events and a lot more top tens than a lot of guys. So I'd like to keep adding to that. But I'd like to keep the dream alive. I'd like to play another British Open and another Masters and another Players Championship. So a few more years of grinding it out here, and then I'll go play with my buddies on the Champions Tour.
And obviously, ending with the round you've chosen there, 1993, in amongst all the individual titles and accolades, it's that team ethic that means most to you.
Yeah, being a part of a team, whether it's Ryder Cup,
World Cup of Golf with Freddie,
President's Cup, World Cup, even back to my Walker Cup days at Pine Valley, being on a team on the board of the PGA Tour, or helping run a PGA Tour event in our hometown through my foundation. Anything that I can give back to the game that's given so much to me, I'm happy to do it.
What an articulate man. He comes across so well, doesn't he? And not surprisingly, very popular golfer, popular man amongst his peers and some of those younger players coming through too. I don't know why, but I was surprised that he felt he had underachieved in his career, given, you know, his resume. But as you heard, other priorities in his life as well. And we sometimes forget that, don't we, when we're watching these sports stars. But a real pleasure to chat to Davis Love, get to meet him properly like that. And hopefully you enjoyed it too. Now, for those of you who listened to Series 1, some of the interviews there, just a little update on Mark Kaya, who had that incredible story. And if you haven't heard it, really well worth going back into the archives to have a listen. Now, Mark's had operation number 28 recently, this time ankle fusion surgery, after finding it so painful to walk the last 2 years. So fingers crossed for him. Hopefully it's a big success. And go back in the archives. They're all timeless interviews as well, so it won't feel hopefully dated to you when you go back to the back catalogue. Please subscribe to the Round Golf Podcast as well. You won't miss a thing. Big thank you, of course, to our sponsors, Red Ray and Navigate Contracting. And thanks to you, of course, for listening. We'll catch up again soon.